Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie, as always, here with John. Still, believe it or not, snowed in.
I'm ready for summertime. I'm tired of ice. I mean, my driveway is a solid sheet of like 4-inch thick ice. It's insane.
There are two tire tracks. Don't want to spend too much time on this, but two tire tracks. It's like a roller coaster. Like I could let go of the steering wheel and your driveway, because of the ice dividers, would just guide me to my parking spot.
So what's funny is I intentionally today, I was like, you know, if I just drove on this big chunk of ice in the middle of those two tire tracks, it will bust it up and, and make it, you know, thaw out faster. It's so thick in the middle. If I try to take my car and scoot over a little bit, it kicks me back out.
It did.
Like it will not let you. So yeah, it's like bumper cars.
Yeah.
It will not let you out of a specific track. Not bumper cars. You know what I'm talking about? There's like that ride at Dollywood that keeps you on the track. So you can, you have a steering wheel, but you can only really move 3 inches to the one way or the other.
It's pretty much just like that. And coincidentally, we're doing a story about travel today. This is about Richard McCoy Jr. And we brought him up during the D.B. Cooper episode. Went a little deeper when we talked to Chris Jericho about D.B. Cooper on Talk is Jericho a couple weeks ago. This is one of the leading suspects, and his story, completely aside from D.B. Cooper, is pretty interesting. So I wanted to bring it up.
It's an awesome story, and I really can't believe just how many instances there were like this back in the day, like in the 60s and 70s. So it's awesome. Before we do that, though, I do want to say thank you so much to our newest Patreon member, Miss Sherry, came in at the $3 level. So this is the perfect time, guys. We just released February's episode this weekend. You want to check it out. It's awesome. Jamie and I researched and wrote it because our writer, Mackenzie, has just had a baby. So it's old school Jamie and John.
Yeah. I mean, hurry back. Hurry back, Mackenzie. Take care of that baby. No, we're excited for her, excited to get back into doing a little bit more of the details ourselves. And so the Patreon episode for February is really good, too. It's a great story.
Yep, it's awesome. Yeah. So go check it out. $3 a month. Everything you would ever want is over there. And that one is only available to Patreon members.
All right, John, get us rolling today.
We are going to go back to the early 1970s, and the skies over America weren't just busy, but apparently they were vulnerable. Like I said, there were a lot of hijacking attempts and just hijacks that actually worked out.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about D.B. Cooper, and I don't know if he's alive and made it after that jump and lived out his days elsewhere, but commercial aviation existed in a strange in-between era. There were flying, you know, people that flew felt glamorous, but there was no security whatsoever. It was, I feel like getting on a bus today is more secure than what the airfare was like back then.
Well, for the most part, only rich people could afford to fly. They were wearing their Sunday best, suits and dresses. They were smoking on board, and it was just a completely different scenario than we have now. And it's hard for us to imagine if you weren't there at the time.
So the story we're going to be talking about today, Richard Floyd McCoy Jr., if I'm not mistaken, this happened less than a year, like 6 months after D.B. Cooper's.
Yeah, it was less than a year for sure.
So this was a time where you could get on a plane, you could have a weapon and a note and a plan and reasonably believe that you might get away with hijacking this plane and getting some loot as you go.
Yeah, McCoy's story is not about desperation. It's not about chaos. It's not like he ran into this with caution to the wind. He was very meticulous in his planning, but he was also very confident. Had a lot of ego, a lot of bravado to go with this, and that may or may not have been what got him caught, but he wasn't a drifter. He's not like a professional thief. He was an educated, married, religious, important man in his community. And he had been through the military, supposed to represent America, truth and justice. And yet he chose to challenge the American system in a really dangerous way, but also a very direct way that impacted people immediately and very dangerously.
Let's get to know this guy just a little bit before we talk about the hijacking. So Richard Floyd McCoy Jr. was born in 1942, right square in the middle of World War II. And he was raised and grew up in a very conservative, structured family. Discipline, obedience, moral clarity, these were the things that were emphasized to him from an early age. Friends and family would later describe him as a man who was intelligent. He was very curious. He was intensely focused once he saw a goal that he wanted to achieve. But he did display early signs of some risk-taking behavior. Nothing like crazy reckless, but just some calculated boldness. Psychologists were later, brought in and examined his actions, and they would describe him as a man who believed that rules applied until he personally outgrew them.
Yeah.
That might be describing me. Like, rules are there, but I'm above the rules sometimes.
Well, I mean, I think it's easy for us to think, yes, we are. The rules are there for a reason. Everybody should follow them, but it's not going to hurt anybody if I do this right now or do that right now. I mean, nobody's going to know. Nobody's going to get hurt.
If I perceive a rule or a policy as stupid, then in my mind, I've written it off. This doesn't apply because it's stupid.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that was really what he was thinking or not.
So, like I said, he wasn't a very impulsive guy. So he took a long time to plan what he was doing. He was very confident in his abilities, which were many, and we'll talk about those in just a second. He believed that expertise could justify an exception to the law. So, yeah, I know you're supposed to do this, but I'm so good at this thing that that doesn't apply to me. I'm such a good driver. I don't need to wear my seatbelt. Famous last words, right?
For sure.
So that belief would quietly shape every decision he made, including the ones we're talking about today. He joined the Army and served two tours in Vietnam. You know, John, you and I were born kind of between wars, and, we were in Iraq and then the war on terror after that. And I feel like we've kind of constantly been in war, but
I mean, almost our entire adult life. Yeah. Because 9/11 happened. I mean, you're a little older than me, but right when I was turning 18 is when 9/11 happened. So until my late 30s, we were at war.
You know, he was born during World War II, and then we're drafting people into Vietnam. So his life was kind of the same way, but in more immediate impact. Since we don't have the draft, I think we're a little more removed than adult men would have been back then. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, he was born during the biggest war of all time, but then he saw the Korean War. And then he was old enough to serve in Vietnam. So he would have been kind of an older man during like the early 90s Gulf War era.
Right. Yeah. He's looking down those whippersnappers. If he had been around, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
So he was trained as a demolition expert and a helicopter pilot. So he had aerial abilities and obviously knew what he needed to do to blow up or not blow up something.
Have you ever watched the movie We Were Soldiers about the Vietnam War?
Yeah.
I hope that's the right movie. But to be a helicopter pilot in Vietnam was insane. And I think I said the wrong war earlier, but We Were Soldiers about Vietnam. But yeah, the helicopter pilots, they had to fly and constantly take just a barrage of gunfire.
Yeah.
Really insane job. So if that's what he was doing and blowing up stuff, this dude is legit.
Yeah, he had to do this under all that pressure, stay calm, make good decisions. People's lives literally depended on him. And he learned that you have to stay calm, that machines will sometimes fail, but people and their reactions can change the result of that. And this wasn't just casual knowledge of things he knew and could pass down. This was essentially, he became a professional survival pilot and soldier.
Yeah. After Vietnam, McCoy continued to fly helicopters, but this time with the Utah Air National Guard. So to him, aviation wasn't a hobby, like some folks. This was about his identity. He basically had helicopter like jet fuel in his body. Like,
right.
He was one with the machine, basically. He understood aircraft layouts, emergency procedures, flight crew dynamics, and that knowledge would later become the backbone of his hijacking plan. But unlike many criminals, he wasn't guessing. He was just going off instincts as he executed his plan.
McCoy was married, had two young kids. They attended church regularly, and as was the custom in the 60s and 70s, he was considered an engaged member of the religious community there locally. He even taught Sunday school. Neighbors saw him as a polite, responsible individual, a trustworthy member of their community. And this outward stability really masked an internal belief that he thought he was smarter than the people around him, that the systems were not in a place to really serve people, that he could subvert them, outsmart them, and serve a little bit of justice on the side.
I mean, this would be like you, my man, like doing something shady without me knowing about it. Because every time I look at you and your family, I see just a guy trying his best, raising a good family, going to church, living life as you should. And that's how this guy looked like.
What you don't know is that I peddle Rogaine out of a local storage unit.
Well, that's good to be a seller and not a user of your own supply. There's no evidence that McCoy's family knew about his criminal intentions, and that secrecy, I don't know, it's kind of disturbing to think that you could live with someone and not know that they have this whole other dark side to them.
Sharing life with somebody is so, like, I don't mean intimate in a sexual way, but like, you know everything about each other, and how do you hide something like this? And a lot of cases we cover have adultery and things like that. I just don't, how do people have time to do these things?
I don't
get it.
That's how I feel about affairs and stuff. Yeah. Is like, I'm too busy running my kids around to even think about ruining my whole life. So anyway, this was a complicated man. He, on one side, he was a family man. On the other side, he's basically a criminal mastermind. And that ability to separate morality from within yourself, I would like to talk to psychiatrists about how he was able to do that. Or maybe he was doing one for the other.
Right.
Maybe he felt like hijacking a plane for money would be good for his family financially.
I would think he's got exactly what you're looking for in like a spy. Like he knows the right things to do, but he's not. I mean, he's willing to go above and beyond the call of morality, if you will. 1970s, skyjackings were alarmingly common. We think famously about 9/11, the terrorist attacks on the Twin Towers. That is what we think about hijacking. There have been a ton of movies about it. But, you know, in the 70s, there was so little security, it was easy to at least attempt a hijacking. The Boeing 727 aircraft had a rear staircase that could be lowered mid-flight. John, I'm not a pilot. For what reason would it make sense to have a staircase open mid-flight?
I think I'm decently smart. I can't think of a reason why. I mean, I know why it would be good to have in general, but not one that could be opened mid-flight. That just seems like a disaster waiting to happen.
Yeah, I mean,
something about drag would be bad.
Yeah, and if there's an emergency, there are other doors if you have parachutes and that kind of thing. But it was super convenient for the hijackers, for sure. Security screenings were minimal, if anything at all. Like, you walked up, you mentioned getting on a bus. Like, essentially, you walked up, you could give cash, write a fake name, and walk on a plane without anybody looking in your briefcase or your bag or whatever. Ransom payments were often quietly made to avoid passenger harm and passengers freaking out, to avoid everybody getting up in a tizzy. To somebody like McCoy, this system looked less like protection and more like an invitation, an opportunity to step in and show what he'd always thought, which was that he is smarter than everybody else.
And then came November 1971, and that is when D.B. Cooper hijacked a plane, and then they basically landed that plane because he said that he had a bomb, and he made his list of demands. They took off on that same plane after all the passengers got out, correct?
Right. And he got his money and parachutes.
Yeah. They met his demands. They got everyone safely off board except for the pilots, of course, and stewardesses.
Yep.
So then they took back off. He waited until he was in the perfect spot. He lowered the staircase that we just discussed by himself and jumped out. And that's, if you want more to that story, we've covered it before. But that story, of course, dominated headlines, And McCoy paid attention, and not with like a fascination, but almost with analysis. It's almost like Cooper didn't inspire mystery in McCoy, but instead he inspired competition. He wanted to do this as well.
So, and do it better.
Yeah, absolutely. On April 7th, 1972, McCoy boarded United Airlines Flight 855 using an alias. I think it was like T. Johnson or something like that.
Yeah, it was super generic, like Dan Cooper for D.B. Cooper.
So he carried a grenade and a pistol. Now, the grenade ended up being fake and the pistol was not loaded, but if to an innocent bystander, you don't know that.
No, and you shouldn't. You should never assume that it's unloaded and fake. Like, always assume it's most dangerous.
Yeah, I know that he had the grenade, and it looked real because it had the pin and everything. So I've seen these, I'm going to say, quote-unquote, replicas where they were used for training purposes. Mm-hmm. It very well could have been one of those. So it actually looked and felt like a grenade, but without the explosives inside. And he took the pin out at one point, and if he let go of the other mechanism, then everyone thought it was going to blow up.
Right.
So basically, you try to hurt me, you might hurt me, but you're going to get killed too, because I'm going to drop this grenade.
And that's kind of the beauty, if you will, of a grenade as a weapon, in that the first piece is an active pulling out of the pin, and then a release is the next trigger. So if I have a grenade in my hand and you shoot me, incapacitate me in some way, I let go of that, we're all getting blown up anyway. So that's why it's so effective and used in situations like this sometimes.
Especially if you're mid-flight, you know, because on the ground, I might be able to take a shot at you from a long range.
Right.
But in an airplane, if I let go of that, it's going to blow a hole in the cabin and we're all going
down. Everybody's done. There's no hope there.
So he also had a carefully typed out ransom note. And shortly after takeoff, he handed the note to a flight attendant, and the message was calm. It was direct. He demanded $500,000 and parachutes. There were no theatrics. There were no threats beyond necessity. It was, hey, this is happening again. I need money and parachutes. And by judging what else he had with the grenade and pistol, he wasn't going to be screwed with.
Yeah, and this is, if you know anything, D.B. Cooper's case is my favorite crime story, still unsolved. And Richard McCoy is a suspect for some people, and that's because what he did here is almost exactly what D.B. Cooper did. The plane lands in San Francisco. They bring on the money and the parachutes. They let the passenger off, and they take off again. They get over rural Utah, and then McCoy jumped, much like D.B. Cooper. D.B. Cooper jumped in the middle of the night the day before Thanksgiving. McCoy's in April. I think if you jump in April in Kentucky, you will, I don't know, probably drown before you hit the ground. So
yeah,
I don't know what it's like in Utah, but it to this point was almost exactly like D.B. Cooper's heist. But it doesn't stay that way. When we get back, we'll talk about how his hijacking differed from Cooper, what ultimately got him caught.
So he landed hard, and when he landed, he got tangled up in some power lines. He hitchhiked, which drew attention, and this allowed the FBI to move quickly. They were able to get fingerprints. They saw his handwriting. They recovered money that tied him directly to the crime. That's something that we didn't see with D.B. Cooper. So that made police know that he survived. He is alive. But unlike Cooper, McCoy left a trail. So within days, FBI was able to arrest McCoy, and the evidence against him was overwhelming. Now, of course, just like any good criminal, he denied involvement in any way. And I think he was arrogant enough to think that he was going to get away with it. He was a very calm, cool, collected guy. He didn't seem stressed out or panicked. McCoy was charged with aircraft piracy, which is an awesome, like, I'm sorry, but that's awesome. Like, you're a pirate, but of airplanes.
We don't have a lot of pirate episodes, so excited about this one
that,
for sure.
That made me so much joy in my heart to say piracy like that. prosecutors detailed every step of the crime, and in trial, the jury heard what they needed to hear in order to convict him of this crime and give him a 45-year sentence. And any chance that he would appeal, and of course he did, but they all failed.
So 45 years for aircraft piracy.
That's a lot, right? I mean, nobody died.
Nobody. I mean, of course, it was potential for dozens of people to die on this airplane.
The grenade was fake. I mean, come on. Yeah, take 5 years off for that.
And I assume, my assumption has always been that he thought, since the grenade's fake and the gun's not loaded, they can't get me for any kind of violent crime here because there was no real threat. And we see murderers get much less than this. So, I mean, I'm okay with this sentence. I just wish murderers would get more.
I'm talking like tongue-cheek stuff. Like, yeah, I'm okay with this sentence. But like you said, I know someone personally who was convicted of, I think, second-degree murder.
Mm-hmm.
And did not even see 10 years inside prison.
Insane. So,
yeah.
I also don't want to skate over piracy without talking about your Napster opinions, because you were a music pirate.
I was.
Indeed. So the court made this clear. They were never able to find D.B. Cooper. Again, this was less than a year later, but they wanted to show people that you're not going to get away with this. Intelligence does not excuse danger, and nobody is above the law. McCoy had crossed a line that he couldn't jump back over. And again,
I see what you did there.
Thanks. Dan Cooper, D.B. Cooper, was he McCoy? That's part of the question. Did he get away with the first one and get greedy and get caught the second time? Or was this a copycat? And we can talk more about that later. But his story does not end there. Richard McCoy was in prison, and he was going to be there most of his natural life. Like, he was still pretty young when this happened, but it was going to be a while. In 1974, he found a way to escape federal prison using a fake gun.
What is it with this guy and fake guns? Does he have a thing against real guns?
Maybe he shouldn't have, because this is obviously not. And how are prison authorities like, oh, he's got a gun?
Like, where did he get, like, what kind of, what was the inmate's name in Shawshank that could just get stuff?
Yeah.
Morgan Freeman's character.
Yeah. Red, was that his character?
Old Red. Yeah. How do you get a fake gun? I think it's easier to get a real gun in prison than it would be a fake gun.
I just imagine him pulling a fake gun out of a cake, and that's where my mind goes, because that's a lot of fun. So this escape mirrored his earlier confidence in thinking, yeah, I can get out of this prison with this fake gun, and they're not going to catch me. However, law enforcement was prepared for this. He wasn't in a county jail, right? Like, they were ready to track him down as soon as he disappeared. It may have taken them a few months, but FBI agents found Richard McCoy, and when they confronted him, he did have a real gun. And their story, because he's not alive to tell it, is that he opened fire on them. They returned fire, and McCoy was killed at the age of 32. His story, which was, in his mind, going to be legendary, set him apart from other thieves, other Americans. But it ended violently at the hands of the FBI, not mythically or not legendarily as he thought it would.
I mean, there are so many similarities between McCoy and Cooper, but, you know, they used the same plane. They did the same thing as far as letting the stairs down mid-flight. The ransom request, I think he even either said he had a bomb or had some kind of box with wires in it to make it look like he did. So there are a lot of similarities. The difference is McCoy left a trail, D.B. Cooper didn't. Was it, you know, I wonder how many people, like, where's the percentages on, was McCoy Cooper? Because I could certainly see how people could get there.
Well, I think he's one of the top five suspects. We talked about all those recently on Talk is Jericho. So that's been the more recent coverage that we did. We did this 8 years ago, so we have some coverage of just us, but the newer stuff's updated and the audio is a little cleaner, so I recommend that. But he's one of the top five suspects, I would say. And recently, in 2023, somebody in his family claimed to have found a parachute on their land that they say is one of the parachutes that D.B. Cooper had. Now, there's been no expert analysis to prove this. I personally think it's crap. I think if...
And this was land that McCoy owned, or...
Yes, that's what his descendants... I don't know if they were his kids or grandkids, but people claim that they found a parachute that matched the same type that D.B. Cooper had on McCoy's land or in his property.
Now, I had went on record saying that I thought D.B. Cooper, whatever his real name actually was, had some kind of military background. Yeah. So obviously McCoy did too. So I wonder if it was a different guy, did McCoy just happen to have one of these parachutes from his military time that he just really liked and had it at the farm, and then 50 whatever years later, it's like, oh, this is a parachute. I bet it was D.B. Cooper's.
You know? Yeah, I think they want him to be, because I think as the family, you don't want to think of your ancestors, your parents, your grandparents as a villain to them. If he's D.B. Cooper, that cleans up his image a little bit, I think. I don't know really how, because I'm a big D.B. Cooper guy.
I wonder if the FBI said, yes, we do think that this guy is also D.B. Cooper, at that point, does the family have any, like, I think there would have to be a trial where a judge said this family cannot make any money off of anything D.B. Cooper related, because ultimately he is a criminal and an outstanding felon. So
I would think any charges against family for covering it up or whatever would be statute of limitations, would be ineligible. But
yeah, I think the only thing they shouldn't be able to earn money
benefit
off
from
of
it.
His like name, image, and likeness, like like an NFL or
a
high
school. He's not a college football player. Yeah. There are a lot of cases like that, and I'm not familiar with how that works with family, but there are a lot of crimes that you can't benefit financially from, which should be all crimes. Some other objections. He was in his late 20s when he survived this jump, which is a main D.B. Cooper question. Did he die? But Richard McCoy was 29. Cooper was probably in his 40s by the time he did his jump, just based on how he looked. So I don't think he's D.B. Cooper. The FBI says he's not D.B. Cooper.
Well, if they say it, then I gotta.
Conspiracy theorists would say that the FBI shot him because they didn't want people to find out he was D.B. Cooper. They were trying to cover up the fact that they couldn't find Cooper.
I wonder if the gun that he had that allegedly fired on FBI, Is that still something that is in evidence somewhere?
It's
actually a cap gun.
That has absolutely been, air quotes, lost at some point somewhere, I think. But I don't think McCoy was Cooper. I think he was trying to one-up D.B. Cooper and get away with it to show that not only could he beat the system, but he could beat the other guy that did it and tried to get away with it. In some true crime circles, McCoy is discussed as the anti-Cooper. He's what happens when skills meet ego. Some see wasted potential. He could have absolutely been a really good asset for our country, for our military, for the FBI, CIA. He had, to quote Liam Neeson, a very particular set of skills that not a lot of people on Earth had. So he could have been a great benefit, but he wanted to prove that he was above everybody else.
I have an interesting stat for you, Jamie, because we mentioned that hijacking planes was kind of a normal affair back in the day. So check this out. Between 1961 and 1962, there were 159 U.S. aircraft that were hijacked. And the peak of that.
Tell me those years again.
1961 through 1972. So 11 years. Now the peak was 1968 through 1972. So within that, 4 to 5 years, 137 their aircrafts were hijacked from the United States. That's a lot. At what point do you not say, you know what? We need better security.
And it wasn't until, I think, 74 that they actually started putting in more security. Obviously, that ramped up after 9/11. As far as we know, D.B. Cooper is the only person to hijack a plane, jump out midair, and get away with it, assuming he lived.
I mean, McCoy did for a minute.
Right, right.
And we have some of the cash that he spent. And that's what makes me think D.B. Cooper didn't survive the landing, because there was no money ever found in circulation.
Yeah, I think that would have been, and you know, there were probably ways to clean it and launder it and that kind of thing. I'm not as, thankfully, not as well versed in hiding money, but I would think there were ways, but was he equipped to do that part? I don't know. I think D.B. Cooper, even if he did survive, wanted to remain unknown. I don't think he was, I think he was in it for the money, not necessarily to send a message. McCoy wanted to be known. He wanted to be known as the guy that beat the system, as the guy that was able to pull this off and get away with it. Even after he was caught, he wanted to be the guy that escaped from prison. So I don't think he matches the mentality of what we think of as D.B. Cooper. And it ended up costing him his life. He was killed in 1974 after fleeing prison, and the rest, I guess, is history. His family continues to, I guess, defend him, and I guess I would too. Not that they said he did anything. They're not saying he didn't do this, but he did try to deny it. He said it wasn't him, even though there was a really strong paper trail. There's no doubt that he did hijack that plane in April of 1972.
I'm trying to look up like a McCoy picture versus the D.B. Cooper like sketch that's out there. And I do think D.B. Cooper in the drawings looks older than McCoy, but I don't know it's that much.
Yeah.
I could easily be talked into McCoy being D.B. Cooper at this point.
Well, we've kind of discussed him at length here. So does the deep dive into Richard McCoy change you at all? Like, you were pretty anti-McCoy every other time we've discussed it. Does this change your idea? Yeah, you're right. The picture's not that far off, except for potentially age.
Yeah, man, I don't know. I don't think D.B. Cooper survived that landing. It was much different. I mean, it was at night, bad storm, middle of nowhere. I don't think that...
November.
I don't think that D.B. had the plan for, like, everything D.B. Cooper did before the jump was just like this guy. McCoy seemed to have a better way of survival after the jump. I don't know.
Maybe don't do it in November over the wilderness in California.
Yeah. Like, maybe wait till you're closer to Mexico.
Contrary to popular belief, all of California is not Los Angeles. So that's not what we're looking at there. McCoy did survive the jump, escaped using a fake gun, and ultimately died in what authorities would say was return fire from the FBI agents. I don't think it was a suicide by a cop kind of thing. I think he was legitimately trying to get away, but...
Can I say something really mean about McCoy?
I would love for you to.
Like, looking at a picture of him, his ears are very prominent in that they stick out, and every rendering of D.B. Cooper doesn't have that. So you would think that if the stewardess was looking at this picture, she would be like, make his ears stick out more.
That's
like, put your fingers behind your ears and stick, push them out, because that's how
his McCoy doors looks. Are wide open.
Have you also heard the theory of serial killers and how their eyes are above the top of their ears?
Ooh, have you ever heard that?
Well, if you look at a picture of McCoy just face on, like straight at his eye level, his eyes are above his ears. So he might have been a serial killer too.
We have headphones on. I'm going to need to check out your eye and ear situation when we take these off.
Fair enough.
A little concerned, bit. Yeah, this is fascinating to me. I've never been shy about D.B. Cooper's case being my favorite. So I chose this to do a deep dive into McCoy, who had a lot of similar traits, similar crimes. But I also was trying to help debunk the idea that he was Cooper, and I still feel the same way as I did before. I don't think he's the guy. I think he was a copycat, a pretty good copycat, but not as good as the D.B. Cooper, which isn't even his real name. So there you go.
Jamie, this was a fun one. I didn't know how much I loved hijacking or piracy before the last few weeks, talking about D.B. Cooper again with Jericho and now McCoy.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. Obviously McCoy died after he got shot, but for the skyjacking, nobody got hurt or killed during the course of the hijacking. So I love a good nonviolent crime. You know, it's brings a little levity to us that we talk about serial killers every week. So I always enjoy getting to tell those stories, and this one is pretty fascinating. So we're, as always, looking for new cases to cover. A great way to send those to us is through a review over on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, social media, or even Google. You can review us wherever you see fit. 5 stars will be delightful, and case suggestions will be added to our list, which John and I are kind of vetting right now as we're dividing up research responsibilities for the coming months while Mackenzie raises a human.
And as you, if you join Patreon, we do have at the top of Patreon, we have a list running. So you can go in, sign in, and create or just add what case you would like us to talk about on the Patreon as well.
Yeah, I'm learning that right now. Guys, we really, really appreciate you. Grateful that people listen, and we look forward to coming back for another case next week.
Guys, we love you. And until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.